ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Will Oxley first sailed across an ocean at just 15. Will was at boarding school in Melbourne when his dad rang, needing his help to bring a boat from the North Pacific to Papua New Guinea. Father and son crewed the boat alone, and Will remembers keeping a bucket near him on night watch to regularly pour cold water over his head to keep awake. Will had been sailing on dinghies since he was a kid, but on that voyage across the Pacific with his dad, he got fascinated by ocean navigation. So Will began to learn the ancient art of celestial navigation using a sextant and the stars. He's now raced around the world 5 times, including the 10 months he spent racing backwards, sailing against the wind. Will was navigator on the Ichiban boat when it won the Sydney to Hobart in 2017 and again in 2019. He also took part in the disastrous 1998 Sydney to Hobart race, when a wild storm led to the death of 6 sailors and the sinking of 5 yachts. Will spent part of that race in an upside-down yacht in the middle of Bass Strait. Hi, Will.
Hi, Sarah.
Will, take me back to that 1998 Sydney to Hobart race. What do you remember about setting out?
Yeah, so I was part of a crew from Townsville, and we were on a boat called B-52, and I'd done the race before a number of times with most of the guys on this boat. The forecast was for relatively strong northeasterlies, and what that means is that the wind direction comes from the northeast, and so when you get out the heads, you can put up a spinnaker, the big coloured sails, and rip south. But we were expecting a fairly robust front to come through. And so those of you that live on the east coast are well aware of the southerly change, and the temperature drops dramatically, and suddenly the wind is coming from the south. And we were certainly expecting that we were going to see quite a lot of wind, maybe 40 knots, but we were far from aware of what was to come when we set off.
Well, what happened, or what had changed by that next morning, by the 27th? What did you wake up to that morning?
So the forecast continued to deteriorate bit by bit. There was some discrepancies between the different bureaus. The Victorian Weather Bureau was saying something slightly different to the Sydney Weather Bureau. But I remember at 6:30 in the morning, this was before... Still really before, certainly, we had access to the internet and on board. And we used a sort of complicated piece of equipment to essentially get a facsimile. And this facsimile comes out and it says that Wilson's promontory was blowing at 71 knots. So that's about 140 kilometres an hour. Now, that was 400 kilometres away, so it was a long way and not immediately expected to affect us, but it was significantly more than the Bureau had been forecasting. And by that stage, we were just beginning to enter Bass Strait. And then I remember at 9 o'clock, or maybe it was 9:30, I repeated that again just before we got out of the range of the land. And Wilson's promontory was now reporting 79 knots. And I'd never seen that in my life at that point.
How many kilometres is that, 79 knots?
So if we call it 80, that's 160 kilometres an hour.
My gosh.
And now Wilson's promontory is 89 metres in the air, the observation station. So you expect that it's going to overread relative to what you see on the water. But even if you reduce 10% from that, it's still a crazy number. So by that stage, we were... well into Bass Strait, and the seas were a conservative 8 metres, and the wind was probably in around 40 knots, so 80 kilometres an hour, which was that, and that's not an unusual wind strength. The forecast suggested that there was this low that had developed, but it was moving, it was to the south of us, and it was moving quite quickly and moving out into the Tasman Sea. So we, at that point, we were comfortable steering a particular course that was safe. We experimented with even taking all of the sails down.
What happens with the boat when you do that in strong winds?
Well, the boat is because in a modern day boat, the keels are much smaller than a more traditional boat, and so the thing becomes a bit, instead of being a cork, it sort of is more like a piece of polystyrene that is getting blown along the surface of the water. So it didn't work very effectively. So we put the storm jib up, which is a very small sail that we put up the front of the boat, and we managed to continue sailing in the direction that we were going. So at this point, we were now, okay, well, we can sail safely in this direction, and the storm is forecast to move to the east, and so things will slowly improve. But of course, they didn't improve. The seas continued to build to a conservative 10 to 12 metres, and the top 2 to 3 metres of those waves were every now and again breaking. And so you would see them pass in front of and behind you, and you would go, well, I'm not sure quite how we deal with that if it hits us. And so we continued. The radio was on full time, and there were distress calls going off all around us. But at that stage, the only thing, it's interesting, people will often say, well, why didn't more boats go to help others? But at that stage, the only thing we could do safely was steer in the direction we were steering in. Mm. The concept of trying to even turn around or get that sail up or down was going to be very difficult to achieve.
Were people, sailors, staying on deck as these winds and waves were picking up?
Well, at 12 o'clock, we checked in with the weather forecast, confirmed that it was supposed to slowly abate, and so we made the decision from 12 that we would shut up the boat, and we had 10 crew on board. And so we would close the hatch, everything would be locked down, and we would just have 2 people on deck, and then we would swap those people over regularly. And I remember that at about 6 o'clock I was lying down below right next to the radio listening to the calls and logging what was going on. And there were helicopters involved, and it was general chaos. I lay back down, and it was very hot and humid because we had everything shut up. And I took my life jacket off, and I took my jacket off, and I just had we have these sort of long johns, and I pulled them down to below my waist and just over the top of my boots. And so now I just had my boxer shorts on, and I was lying back listening to the radio. And then I remember hearing this tremendous roar and then this large crash and bang, and the boat was literally picked up and thrown upside down through 180 degrees.
Do you remember falling? What was the experience after you've been lying down? How physically shook up were you?
There's not a huge amount of space, but I then... there were 2 people in bunks just beside me, and I remember I landed on them. And, of course, all these sails that we have down below are now on top of various people. And I remember the first thing that went through my mind was, oh, no, I've literally been caught with my pants down. And so now we've got we established that there were the 8 people that were down below were okay, and there was, it was 6:30 in the evening by then. So the boat's upside down, 180 degrees, and suddenly it's gone from being this incredible amount of noise to actually quite peaceful and quiet. And we have portholes in the hull, and so they're now underwater. And the light, there were just the rays of light coming up through those portholes, and so there was enough light, and we could all see each other. It was actually relatively calm. And there were a couple of things I remember. One guy said, oh, we've got to go get the people on deck. And I'm like, well, there's nothing we can do about them right at the moment. If you open that hatch, we'll just sink. And so we are standing there in about a metre of water. I mean, these boats have a big keel. And so we assume that the keel has actually must have fallen off because a boat shouldn't be stable at 180 degrees. But of course, what happened is that we had, you know, had eight people standing on the boat upside down with all these sails, and we had maybe a meter of water. And so it's in that situation that's actually stable at 180 degrees.
But you don't want to open the hatch because water will just flood in. Well,
yes.
Was there water coming in at all?
Yes. But it was because you've now got a large volume of air. If you picture a cup that you turn upside down and you push it down into a sink of water, the air is contained within the cup. And so that was the situation that we were in.
Were people panicking, Will?
No, people were not panicking, but one of the crew got a little excited, and he was suggesting to me that I needed immediately to send out a mayday call. And I remember that the radio relies on the antenna, and the antenna is attached to the mast, and the mast is upside down in the underwater. And it also relies on the plane of the water to help with the signal. And now the hull's up in the air, so that the thing just won't work. And so I said something along the lines of, oh, I'll do it at the appropriate time.
Really?
So
in that tone of voice?
Pretty much. And the guy ran over. And, of course, everything's in the wrong place, because if you can picture your house turned upside down, imagine trying to walk around in your house that's now everything's 180 degrees different. It's quite confusing. And so he gave out a perfect mayday, but, of course, no one answered. And I had time. I always carry what we call wet notes, which is it's waterproof paper, and you have a little pencil. And so I had time to start writing notes. And I wrote that Eden, which was our closest safe port, was 77 miles away at a bearing of 338 degrees. So I had time to write that in the notebook. And we were discussing how we were going to get the life rafts out, and we were looking at the front hatch, which was pumping up and down as we moved up and down in the waves, and at any time looking like it might pop. And then after about, of course, it seemed like forever, but it was 3 to 5 minutes, another huge wave hit us, and it must have hit we're not quite sure of the sequence, but essentially it hit the boat, and the boat quickly rolled through 180 degrees again. And so now we're back upright, but there was a sequence of events that happened there quite quickly. The guy that was keen to do the radio call and open the hatch, he rushed out, pushed at the hatch very quickly to get out, and, of course, unfortunately, ripped the hatch off at that point. And then he ran out, and there were the two guys that had been on deck. One had we are attached with these tethers, and then we have a line that runs from the bow of the boat to the stern of the boat. So the idea is that you can attach to that, go to the front of the boat to do something, and come back. And so what happened is, when the boat flipped to 180 degrees, he got sort of thrown clear, but he was still attached. And so he somehow managed to just slide along the rope. And so, because he looked up and he could see that there was a keel and there was a rudder, and he didn't want the boat to flip again and obviously be hit by those things. So he decided that being at the front of the boat was the safest thing. And so he was still attached to the boat. The boat was upside down. And then when it flipped back up, because he was attached to it, it sort of flipped him back on. And the other guy, he was steering. And so when we'd gone upside down, he had his life jacket on, but he had gone through the wheel. It was a big wheel. And so now he was upside down, underwater, trapped in the boat. And so he had to unclip himself and swim out. And luckily, you have two choices on your life jacket. You can have an auto-inflating life jacket, which as soon as it gets the pressure of the water, it inflates. Or you can have a manual life jacket. And when you pull the ripcord, like you see on every aircraft when they do the demonstration, then the life jacket inflates. Now, we choose to use the manual inflate because we think it's safer, and this is the reason why. If he had had the auto inflate, he would have then been immediately buoyant and been trapped underneath the boat without any air, and would have drowned Instead, he was able to swim out and then inflate his life jacket. But unfortunately, now he found himself some distance from the boat going, oh, this is not ideal. I'm in the middle of Bass Strait. And so he managed to surf back to the back of the boat and get his arm around one of the ropes that was there. So when the boat came upright, he clambered back on deck and he just turned around as soon as he got on board and he started, the mast had broken when, and we presume that happened when the boat came back upright. And he just turned around and started undoing things to get ready to deal with the mast. Not even, and meanwhile, I was down below and when we flipped back upright, all the sails had landed on everyone. And I turned around and I could just see some legs. And Linda Axe, one of our crew, she had got her head stuck underneath the stove. And so I dragged her legs out and she, because the stove, it was all underwater as well. And so then dragged her out and she popped up and her blonde hair was covered in blood because she cut it. So I was, I remember dealing with that while the other guys were dealing with the cutting the mast away.
Oh my gosh.
Two very lucky people.
Two very lucky people, absolutely. Is that at all a common experience in ocean racing, to be in a boat that gets flipped by a big wave? Had it happened to you before?
No, it's not a common experience. And as a result of the 1998 Hobart, the angle of vanishing stability, which is the degree to which a boat can go over before it becomes unstable, has been dramatically increased. So it's something like 130 degrees now. I think back then it might have been 112 degrees. And what that means is where previously a boat that gets knocked over to 112 degrees, so obviously the mast below the water, if it goes beyond that, then it will continue. Whereas now the angle of vanishing stability is much greater, so the boats pop back upright. There were a huge number of changes made as a result of that 1998 Sydney Hobart.
So all of the crew on your boat on the B-52 were wonderfully, thankfully safe, and the boat's righted again and everyone's on board, but you don't have a mast and is there other damage to the boat? What did you do next?
Yeah, so the boat is now upright, got at least a metre of water, and of course the hatch is no longer able to be pulled shut.
So, and the hatch is the little door between the hull and the top of the boat.
Yeah, to go below, you go through the hatch. And so we managed to get the motor started. And I remember I had a chat with my very good friend, Wayne Miller, who was the owner and skipper of the boat. And I said, oh, Wayne, the radios are not great. We need to turn on the EPIRB, which is the emergency position beacon. And Wayne's at 6'6" and a giant of a man and had worked in the mines and everything. He said, oh, but Will, that's for grave and imminent danger. And I said, Wayne, let's go through this. So the boat has full of water. The radios are not working. We haven't yet started the engine, and its structural integrity is in some doubt. That's what they mean by grave and imminent danger.
Was he waiting for alien invasion or something? I don't know what would qualify.
Well, he then just said, "Oh yeah, good point." And those that were watching the conversation say that that's pretty much how it went, and that was pretty much the tone of the conversation.
So once you sent out that EPIRB, did you get help?
Well, we thought that we had back then a 406 EPIRB, which was then a modern EPIRB, would tell the safety people who we were and where we were, as opposed to just a signal that they didn't know who it was from. And so we managed to get the engine going and we were able to start motoring to the north. We couldn't head directly at Eden because of the waves and the danger. But at about 10:30 at night, a Sea King helicopter turned up and he reported later that he was on hover at 77 metres above the ocean and he nearly ditched it because of a wave coming past him.
Oh my God, in the helicopter?
Yeah. So he was on auto hover struggling. And so we have much better communications with helicopters now, but back then communications were not ideal and our radios were all out. And so he sent down a rope and then he sent down a little bag with a message in it, but the message was written on paper and that was totally destroyed. So we had this weird communication. He could see we got everyone on deck. He could see that we had a full crew. Everyone appeared calm and safe. And so from his perspective, he was trying to figure out, and we weren't about to, it was clear that they would be keen for us to jump into the water in order for them to send someone down to pick us up. And we weren't that keen that that was going to be a good idea. And then suddenly he disappeared, just disappeared. And we now know he went to another yacht, which was the Sword of Orion, which had problems. And so we then just continued on our way.
And all of your equipment would have been damaged. I mean, how were you navigating the boat?
So I was navigating largely using dead reckoning. But I managed to get, we had a handheld GPS, which was an unusual thing in those days. And I managed to get a signal on that every now and again when I took it outside. And so I had a paper chart, which somehow was dry. I'm not quite sure how. But I knew the coast pretty well and I knew where Eden was. So I was just able to do it by largely dead reckoning. But unfortunately, every now and again, an over-enthusiastic steerer would say, oh, we should head for Eden now. So they would point the boat towards Eden. And then, of course, one of these huge waves would crash over us and the boat would nearly tip over again. And on one of the occasions that happened, the wave was so big that it pushed out all of the windows on the side of the boat and several tons of water rushed into the boat as it continued to sort of destroy itself around us. So we hammered bits of timber in and we stuck sails in the hole and we managed to get quite close to Eden. And I remember it was this was in 98. So people had mobile phones and they just changed over to digital. And so we had all these mobile phones on the boat. So I'm reaching out the hatch, trying not to get them wet, trying to get a signal. And one guy, one of the Luddites on board, John Bird, he had hung on to his analog phone. Thank goodness. And the analog phone had a much better signal. And so he still gets in trouble from his wife because I used his phone to ring someone else other than his wife. But I rang AMSA, which is the Maritime Safety Authority, and it rang out and then it rang through again and someone answered and I said, good day. And they went, oh, we're a bit busy at the moment. Can you go away? And I said, actually, we're one of the people that you're looking for. And so we had a conversation and I explained where we were, that we were looked like, because we now got some protection from the east coast of Australia because we'd got out of Bass Strait and the sea state had improved. And so we left our EPIRB on. We motored into Eden under our own steam about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
So had your family not known where you were? Were you counted as missing during that night?
Yeah, unfortunately, even though we had the 406 EPIRB, there'd been some confusion. And so we were one of the boats that night on the news, it was grave fears are held for the crew of B-52. So it was that after about from, say, 7 p.m. to 2 p.m. the next day, the families were told that they had no idea where we were.
What did your partner tell you about that experience when you could speak to her again?
Well, I had done a lot of sailing even by then, and so she said that she felt pretty calm about it, that we were an experienced bunch of people, until one of the other wives rang her up and said, they're all dead. And at that point she went, oh, I'm sure they're not, but I need to take this a bit more seriously. And so she was pretty happy to eventually hear from me.
How was it for you to hear that six other sailors had died on that race?
Yeah, it was incredibly confronting situation, and actually I went to a number of the funerals in Sydney afterwards, and I imagine there was an element of that sort of survivor's guilt that well, just by for the grace of God, we were still around and other people weren't. But by the same token, we did the right things at the right time, and as a result of that, we all survived. And so that message of being well prepared, sailing with people that you trust, and sailing in a well-found boat have obviously stuck by me. The other thing that's happened since 98 is that the quality of the weather forecasting has improved dramatically, and our ability to access that weather information has improved dramatically.
And have you done the race again since then?
Yes, I've done it 19 times. And it's not going to paint me in a good light, but in 2003 we managed to win the race line honours, and then in 2004 in the same boat the keel broke and we ended up in the life raft. So I have had my fair share of incidents.
Well, when you started ocean sailing as a teenager, there was no GPS technology. How did you learn to navigate?
So we were living in Sydney at that point, and it was before internet. I'm not sure. I must have looked up in a yachting magazine and found an advertisement for a guy named Barry Lewis who was teaching celestial navigation, and that's what we call navigating by the stars. And so back in the 80s, early 80s, before there was GPS, as you say, you had to demonstrate that you could do celestial navigation in order to be able to even navigate a yacht in the Sydney to Hobart race. And so I decided at 16 or 17 that this would be a good skill for me to learn.
How do you go about learning to navigate by the stars?
There's a lot of maths involved, and Barry Lewis, though, was the son of Dr. David Lewis, who circumnavigated Antarctica in a steel boat called Icebird and wrote several books. And he also spent a lot of time in the Pacific learning about the traditional art of navigation from the Polynesians. So his son had picked up the traditional skills from his father, but he was also now teaching the more conventional skills. So we start off in the classroom and deal with quite a bit of the theory. And then we use a device called a sextant, which is essentially measures angles.
So what does it look like? Describe a sextant. What's it like to hold in your hand? Well,
in the olden days, they were called a quadrant, and it has a series of mirrors, and essentially, the mirrors are split in half, and what you're trying to do is, through one half, you're looking at the horizon, and in the other half of the mirror, you're trying to have the heavenly body that you're looking at. And the idea is that you bring that heavenly body down to the horizon, and you measure the angle. And so, by knowing the angle from that body to the horizon, and then a number of other mathematical calculations, you can determine that you're somewhere on a big circle, somewhere on the Earth. And, of course, that circle is so large that for the purposes of navigation, you can turn that circle into a straight line. So when you take a sight, you know you're somewhere on some straight line, somewhere on the planet.
That's your starting point, yes.
Yeah, and so going back to the days of Captain Cook, they would take sights and get what was known as a noon sight. And that was when the sun was at its highest point. And the benefit of a noon sight was that meant that the sun was either directly to the north or to the south of you, depending on where you were. And so when you drew that line, it was in fact a line of latitude. So that meant that you knew where you were in a north-south context.
The way you're describing it will, it's carefully and as precisely as possible drawing these angles. But of course you're doing this on a boat, and I imagine you're moving about and sometimes moving about a lot. How does that play into the measurements you're taking with a sextant?
Yes, well, it seems ridiculous now when we deal in centimetres with GPS. But back then, 1 degree meant an error of 1 nautical mile, nearly 2,000 metres. So when you're bouncing up and down and you're trying to sight upon a very small star, for example, it's incredibly difficult, and you're trying to get the angle correctly. And the other thing that you need to do is that you need to have the time exactly right. So you're juggling a piece of paper and a pen and the time and the angle.
What happens, though, Will, if you're out at sea and it's cloudy and you can't get a reading off a star or the sun? What can you do then?
Yeah, then you have a problem. And you do what's known as dead reckoning. In the olden days, they used to throw something off the bow and time how long it took to get to the stern. And using that time, they would calculate how fast they were moving. And then, of course, you have a compass that will tell you the direction that you're heading in. But, of course, those measurements are where you are moving across the water. But if the water's moving as well, if there's a strong current, for example, and the current, like take the East Australian Current, for example, it can sometimes move at a speed of 4 knots. And if you're only doing 6 knots and you're going perpendicular to that current, which is going at 4 knots, then you're going to be a long way away from where you think you are at the end of that dead reckoning. Mm. And so the longer you go without knowing exactly where you are, the more error
the more trouble you can get into. Yeah.
Now, when GPS came along, initially the yacht racing said, oh, well, that'll be an unfair advantage, and they prevented you from using them initially. And so you still had to have this skill of celestial navigation. Now the art has largely been lost, and so I feel very competent as a modern day navigator. But if I had to pick up the sextant again in anger, I would be back to an 18-year-old grappling with the thing, trying to remember just what I needed to do.
So do young sailors today not learn those skills the way you did?
No. In fact, the Navy, it used to be a requirement in the Navy, and it also used to be a requirement when I got my commercial ticket in Queensland. I had to demonstrate celestial navigation in order to get a marine ticket that allowed me to go to an extended distance offshore, but that no longer.
You've sailed around the world 5 times. When you are involved in one of these great ocean races, Will, as the navigator, what's your day look like?
My day is very much determined by the timing of new weather information. And so the job of a modern day navigator has shifted completely from trying to know where you are, because you know where you are, to within a few metres at all times. But what you're trying to determine is how to make the best use of the prevailing winds and currents, but then the winds and currents that are expected to occur over the next 3, 5, 7, 10, even 20 days, depending on the voyage. And so every time I'm able to access new weather information, I run complex computer modelling and determine what I believe to be the best route that the vessel will take. Now, of course, the computer itself knows no fear, so that's where the skill of the navigator comes in, because if you have, for instance, a strong wind against a very strong current, then the sea state becomes very short, the waves can break, and of course it's a very dangerous situation. So that you, as the navigator, need to put in the safety margins.
Put in, and of put course, in the human experience of yes. sailing any particular way. If you're having to take in all that information, the weather information, assessing the winds, all of that, does that mean you're on call all the time?
That's right. It does mean I'm on call all the time. I typically would get to sleep uninterrupted for a maximum of about 90 minutes.
What? It's worse than having a baby, Will. For how many days at a stretch?
That could be up to the longest period non-stop I've done at sea is 61 days. But I've learnt over the years how to nap for very short periods of time. I can feel refreshed after 15 minutes, and I've learnt that I can rest for up to about 20 minutes, and then I can awaken easily, or I have a cycle of about 90 minutes. And then after the 90 minutes, I wake up. I either need to get up and check where we are, answer the questions, or ideally I go back into another 20 minutes or an hour and a half. If I get woken, which I often do after, say, 2 hours, then I'm in the middle of another sleep cycle, and so you are much more groggy. So
you're an angry bear. What's your technique for getting to sleep so quickly? Like, how do you do that in the middle of a boat with noise and other people, and I'm not imagining a king-size bed or any other comforts? How do you get yourself to switch off so quickly?
Well, 50% of the time I'm still in my wet weather clothes and I'm sleeping on wet sails. But the short answer is tiredness. You're so tired that just to be able to close your eyes is an amazing thing. And so I might know that at, say, 3 p.m., a very important new piece of weather information's coming in, and I can't do anything until I get that, and it might be 2:30 p.m. And so what I've learnt to do is to just set a short alarm, lie down, shut my eyes for that 20 to 25 minutes, and then I wake up more refreshed and able to use my brain to answer the questions that come up.
I guess I should ask if there's coffee on board to assist in this.
There's definitely coffee. And the other thing that I'd learnt is that when I was early in my career, I would go gangbusters for 3 or 4 days and make fantastic decisions. And then on the fourth and fifth day, my decision-making deteriorated quite dramatically. And so I've started to routinely log my sleep, and I've done it for the last 2 Round the World races, and I know when I need to get some more sleep. So every 4 or 5 days, I try to find a period of time where I can try and get, say, a 3-hour uninterrupted sleep, and then kickstart again and go for the next 4 to 5 days.
Have you become pretty good at sizing someone up quickly in terms of how they might fit with other characters on a boat? Can you do that yourself, do you think?
My experience is that the quietest people are the most competent in general. If in 3 minutes someone's told me their 10 stories about the sailing that they've done, you tend to go, you know, step back a bit. But the people that have achieved the most and are the most impressive individuals in the sport of sailing are typically the most modest individuals that you would have no idea of what they have done, because they're not going to tell you unless you read about it.
When you're not poring over your computer and navigation charts and weather information, I'm guessing you get to spend a lot of time looking at the sea in terms of those longer races. What encounters have you had, Will, with birds or with sea creatures out there in the middle of the ocean?
As sailors, we are incredibly lucky to see the places that we see. And the Southern Ocean in particular is a place of just an amazing place to be. Because you're below all of the continents, the waves just continually go round and round and round and get bigger as they go around. And so it's very isolated. The water is cold, but there is a lot of wildlife. I've been lucky enough to see and sail alongside hundreds and hundreds of pilot whales surfing along at 30 knots beside me. It's always amazing when you get down into the south and you see the first of the wandering albatross, which just may spend several hours just soaring behind the boat. And then there are times when the wind may be 50 knots, you're battling mountainous seas and there's spray and splume everywhere. And there's these little stormy petrels that are not much bigger than, half the size of a can of Coke. And they are flittering around, eating plankton, which is blowing around in the splume with not a care in the world. And you're in this maelstrom trying to survive. And these little birds are kind of going, well, thank you for stirring up this spray. It's been very helpful in allowing us to eat.
What's your favourite time of day at sea?
Dawn, I would say. you're generally pretty exhausted, and when that the first rays of the sun start to appear, and then finally I never tire of a beautiful sunrise.
Not long before the ill-fated Sydney to Hobart race in 1998, what ad did you see in a magazine that set your racing on a different course?
Yes, so I remember this very, very clearly. So it was about September 1998, and I went into the newsagents and picked up a copy of Yachting World magazine. And I was there with my now wife, and she remembers it quite clearly as well. And I looked at this ad in the back of the magazine before I bought it, and it said, the world's toughest yacht race, skippers wanted. And I read through the ad and I said, Sue, this looks interesting. And she just looked at me and said, oh, yeah, that does look interesting. And so I bought the magazine. I went home, looked at it in detail, and they were essentially looking for skippers to lead a team of amateurs in a round-the-world race called the BT Global Challenge.
And what made it the toughest race?
The idea of a normal round-the-world race is that as the sailors of old did, you make use of the prevailing currents and winds. So the traditional way, for example, to get from the United Kingdom to Australia is to come down through the Atlantic Ocean, to stick to the west side of the Atlantic Ocean, because you make use of the high pressure, which means you go downwind, you pop into the Southern Ocean, the strong westerly winds push you downwind to Australia. And then often they would return by continuing east and going around Cape Horn and going back up through the Atlantic. So that's what's known as a traditional route.
Well, it makes sense when you describe it, Will. That makes it sounds like a sensible way to sail.
It does sound a sensible way to sail. But there's a gentleman named Che Blyth, now Sir Che Blyth, who was an English Marines, you know, military guy, and he didn't know much about sailing, but he decided he wanted to sail around the world, and he decided that he should go the wrong way around the world. And by that I mean that he decided he should sail around the world upwind, and so go around Cape Horn from east to west, and then sail upwind all the way through the Southern Ocean, and then come back up through the Atlantic.
That just sounds so mad. I mean, it's hard enough to sail around the world, even with the winds helping you, but sailing upwind the whole way.
Yeah, it's not the most sensible of ideas. But so Che did this, and he held the record. And then some years later, he decided that it was such a good idea that he would organise a race for amateurs, and they would
amateurs like this. Now it's getting even madder. Why amateurs?
Well, he wanted to set it up as a business. So there were two of these races that had previously been held until I came into the picture. And so the one I was signing up for was in 2000, 2001. And these people were paying, at that time, I remember it to be about £24,000. So at that stage, it would be at least 50,000 Australian dollars for the chance to
sail the wrong
bang
way.
Your head against a brick wall for 180 days. And worse still, they were looking for one professional skipper to be in charge of these amateurs who didn't necessarily have to know how to sail when they signed up.
And you put your hand up?
Yeah. So it was interesting. I put my hand up and put in the paperwork, but I had heard nothing. And then along came the 1998 Sydney Hobart. I did that. We got out of it. And I remember thinking, actually, I may have many faults, but one of the things I am quite good at is being calm in a crisis and doing the right thing. And I found it to be, on the whole, a positive experience rather than a negative experience. And that sounds strange, but those of us that have been in terrible scrapes and got out of them will not necessarily regard it as a bad experience. And so this just indicated to me that perhaps this race wasn't such a silly idea. So it turned out that 187 people applied from all around the world to be skippers in this yacht race. And so I sent all the paperwork in. And essentially we were largely doing psychometric testing. And so there was a whole lot of things they would get us to do. Some of them would create a stressful environment, and then you would be given a short period of time to figure out how to solve a particular problem. And then
related to sailing, or could it be about anything?
Generally, totally unrelated to sailing.
You passed all of that rigorous testing, and you were accepted, and you were nominated as skipper. What did you think when you met your crew of amateurs?
Yeah, so that was an interesting experience in itself. So each boat had 18 people on board, so there were 17 amateurs. And essentially, at that point, they almost like they drew them out of a hat. You were told who your sponsor was, and you were given a folder with your crew. Now, they tried to even it out across boats, so my crew ranged in age from 19 to late 60s. And a mixture of males and females. You then had from January to September, when the race started, to mould them into a crew. And you had maybe 20, 25 days with them in over that period of time, because, of course, all of these people were madly trying to raise money so they could afford to come and go on this madcap adventure.
Thing. So how did you do that? What did you do in 25 days to form a crew?
Well, I had a good friend who ran a team development company, actually, and he was working with big business. I got him involved, and so we also did a lot of team development work where we tried to understand what made everyone tick in the team. But at the same time, we were working hard to try to bring up their levels of sailing experience. And so we broke the boat into different parts and tried to decide what areas of the boat that different people might be good at. And so they then had a job description, and we worked up a standard operating procedure for how to go through a particular process, be it putting the sail up or taking it down. And so we then would continually repeat those things. And many of them were like, well, we want to get onto the really exciting racing bit. And it's like, well, no, we just need to cover off all of these things, because everyone needs to do it exactly the same way, because if we're bashing upwind in 50 knots in the Southern Ocean and you decide to do it in a different way than the person next to you, then that can cause an accident. And so we built up a process, and we ended up with an extremely competent crew that achieved great success in the race.
That's extraordinary to me, because you're describing it in such a sort of calm, ordered way, Will, but I can't help but think there must have been certain nights, middle of the night, we'd think this is never going to work. These guys are never going to be able to get us safely around the world the wrong way.
There were certainly times when it was stressful, and we came around. I do remember coming around Cape Horn, and the seas were building. And we ended up very quickly under a storm jib, which is the same type of sail that we had in the 1998 Hobart, a little strip of orange. And we were going upwind in big waves in 50 knots of wind. And I was thinking, wow, New Zealand is a long way away. But this time we were in a 72-foot steel yacht.
Steel?
Purpose-built. Yeah, purpose-built. And able to withstand the rigours of the Southern Ocean.
So was it a completely different experience sailing against the wind than the other races you've done?
Yeah, it's positioned itself as a benchmark for me. Whenever I'm feeling like this is not much fun, I think, well, it can't be as hard as that.
How long did it take?
So the race itself took 10 months. I took 18 months off work. I remember I was working for the Australian Institute of Marine Science here in Townsville as a scientist, and I managed to convince them that instead of going and doing an MBA, instead I would take 18 months off and race a boat around the world with a bunch of amateurs, and that would be my MBA. And they went for it.
I think you should have got a PhD for that. Forget the MBA. Anything they could throw at you, any title you deserve after that.
Yeah.
Do you stay in contact with that crew? You must have formed such a bond after that.
Yeah, well, in fact, it was a great pity that 2020 was the 20-year anniversary. So we had a huge celebration planned in the UK. I had the flight booked and everything.
Do you imagine there'll ever be a time when you stop doing these kind of high-stress, high-demand races and, I don't know, get back on your dinghy and just potter about the coast?
I do think there is a limited life racing at this high level around the world. I think that things like the Sydney to Hobart, you can continue to do. It's just going to require that I sail on bigger boats. At the moment, I sail on a 52-footer, which is essentially a large dinghy. That is very physically demanding, and you probably will struggle to do that at 70, but there are plenty of boats that you can continue to sail on well into your old age. And one of the beauties of the role of navigator is that with age and experience comes wisdom. And so I've learnt a lot and made a lot of mistakes along the way. And so hopefully you can continue to use those skills for slightly longer than perhaps someone who's winding the winches and trying to do the much more physical part of the work on board.
Well, long may you continue to do so, Will. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thanks, Sarah. It was a pleasure.
I spoke with Will Oxley in 2021, and Will recently completed his 21st Sydney to Hobart race on the yacht Scallywag. These days, Will spends most of his time sailing in Europe on a 111-foot-long boat called Raven, which he describes as a very cool yacht. So if you see that passing by, give it a wave. Will also recently appeared on an episode of the gripping ABC TV series I Was Actually There, talking about the 1998 Sydney to Hobart race, and you can watch that on iView Now. This episode of Conversations was made on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. The producer was Nicola Harrison, and the executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Sarah Karnoski. Thanks for listening.